The following edited podcast has been declassified by the Banzai Institute for Biomedical Engineering and Strategic Information.
Welcome all Hong Kong Cavaliers, Blue Blazer Regulars, Radar Rangers, Kalani Brothers, and Rug Suckers to 5 Minutes of Banzai, the only podcast on the internet that discusses, dissects, and analyzes the W.D. Richter cult classic, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Brett Stillo, one of your hosts on this amazing podcast adventure, and joining me, as always, is noted thermopod gunner, parachutist, and a guy who once offered me a crisp new $20 bill, Josh Horowitz.
Hello, Brett. How are you doing today?
I've possibly had a little too much coffee, but sometimes it's a necessary thing to get through these podcasts. You don't want me to sound all sleepy, so.
No. Definitely in the minutes we're going to be discussing today, we'll wake you up for sure. This is the climax, the climactic ending of this film. And we are lucky enough to discuss this with a great friend and podcaster from the X Minutes podcast. We have Steve Lasto. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, gentlemen.
Hello. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, Steve. Great to have you on, sir. How are you today?
I am well, and it's a pleasure to join you guys here at the Banzai Institute.
Yes, I always like to have good guests, good people who enjoy talking about films. And this is Buckaroo Banzai. We're almost done with this, but I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about this film. When was the first time that you remember seeing it, Steve?
I didn't see this movie until about 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what I think part of the reason I watched it because you guys were covering it and asked me to be on the show. Mm-hmm. But I remember seeing it like on HBO in the 80s, or, you know, at least commercials for it on HBO in the 80s, and not really feeling like it was my cup of tea. And I managed not to drink of said cup until recently.
That does follow the pattern. Yeah. So many of our guests have had the same story, you know, sort of stumbling onto it on cable and scratching their head and saying, what's this? My prepubescent mind is confused. But yeah, it's interesting that in your case, you didn't bite. There's something I was like, nah, this is too weird. Bookmark.
I don't think it was the weirdness that struck me as a problem. I think that it's the weirdness combined with the sort of subpar 80s special effects. I think that was hard for me to swallow back in the day. Like I actually kind of enjoy the effects now. There's one in this minute, in this scene, in this, how do we say it? 5 minutes in this 5 minutes in these minutes, in these minutes,
these
there's
minutes.
One of these minutes that I enjoy. Yes. but when I was a kid, or a teenager, that would take me too far out of it. Even if it was like, I liked weird, but the weird combined with, bad effects, like the Never Ending Story is another good example, would just pull me out of it. And I can't stand Labyrinth. I know everybody loves Labyrinth. No disrespect to David Bowie.
You know, I wonder if you probably saw the effect that they probably showed a lot when they would show trailers for this and stuff, you know, just the Panther ship crashing through the wall, you know, that model. I bet you they probably showed that and maybe some of the shots of the ships going around and stuff. I can kind of see how, I guess if you were used to some of the really good stuff that we would get from the Star Wars movies or even some of the Star Trek ones, that you can get a little biased when you see stuff that isn't quite up to that level.
I think another part of it for me is like strong narrative will carry me through everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of my thing that I'll, you know, I can sit through a lot if I really like the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably the third thing that plays into it. But it's for some reason, I don't know why, this, it seems to be enduring through time, maybe even gaining strength.
Yeah.
So something's up there, guys. This movie.
I was commenting to Brett before we came on that when I first sort of approach this movie, it wasn't really my favorite film. I mean, Big Trouble in Little China certainly was one of them, and I kind of found out years later that the two movies were related in a way. But I remember watching it and just not quite getting a lot of the really subtle nuances that you saw in the film. And I felt that the action was a little bit lacking and stuff. Years later, I find that it's got its charm. It's got some really fun performances by actors who would later become, you know, much better known, I guess, for some of the other stuff. And I still have always liked the intro just because I think it's like the right stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's the yin and the yang of the cult movie. You mm-hmm. know, we like them because they're outside the mainstream, but you know, they're like foreign sports cars. They have their little quirks. mm-hmm. And, yeah, you know, it's also interesting. You know, I think the kind of films that we all like, you know, again, they're the cult films. They're sort of the fantastic films. And, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a little bit of peer pressure sometimes.
Hmm.
Oh, you'll love this one, man. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't.
Hmm.
And you know, you feel a little left out. I can think of one, in my case, The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was one.
I love The Big Lebowski.
So. Yeah. I wanted to love The Big Lebowski. And I, you know, I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. But first time I saw that one, boy, that movie annoyed the hell out of me.
Hmm.
And, you know, meanwhile, all my friends were quoting lines from it. And they're having Big Lebowski parties. And I felt isolated and alone and a little scared. And, In that movie, I actually ended up watching it about four times and finally having a major breakthrough with a movie therapist I was seeing at the time. We kind of worked out some issues I had with The Big Lebowski, and now I get it. But, you know, again, at the time I was not feeling it. Meanwhile, everybody else was whooping it up. And so that happens sometimes too. You know, everybody's saying, you're going to love it. And I'm saying, no, I don't.
I would say that I've gained more of an appreciation for Buckaroo Banzai having gone through this exercise of the 5 minutes at a time. I think that's kind of a common theme with many of the films that these podcasters doing these movies by minutes seems to get. Would you say, Steve, that for some of the movies you've covered, you've appreciated the movies more having gone through the exercise?
So with Princess Bride, I think by the time Princess Bride was over, I never wanted to talk about Princess Bride again. and I think that might have been that the scene where I can't remember what it's called. The scene where they play the game at the Rock. What do we call the scene?
Jumanji?
No.
Oh wait.
See, I've completely blocked the movie out of my head at this point.
Oh, you're talking about Andre with the Rock?
No, the game of mental strength between
the Battle of Wits?
And the Battle of Wits. Thank you. Okay. See, I've really blocked it out at this point. So when we went through that scene, I think I hit a point where I sort of had enough of talking about The Princess Bride. Mm-hmm. But with the X-Men movies, that I'm really, really enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding my appreciation for the movies definitely going up as we continue on through the movies. Even like Famke Janssen, even her at this point, I'm starting to like. And she was the thing I didn't like about the movie when we started. But so for those movies, definitely going up. For Princess Bride, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But to return to that theme of movies you're supposed to like, I have been trying to unconditionally love Blade Runner for decades.
The original, yeah.
Yeah. I like it now, but I don't love it.
Mm.
Yeah, fair enough. That's another one that I've kind of had a tug of war with over the years. Again, working with the movie therapist and you know, dealing with some stuff, crying a lot. I like that movie a lot more.
The movie therapist. That sounds like the name of a good podcast right there.
The movie therapist.
Yeah.
If I can make money off it, I'm doing it. Because, yeah, boy, you know, I know a lot of people who saw The Exorcist when they were way too young. So yeah, there's where the money is.
All right. Well, I think on that note, we should probably get to these minutes here. So we're talking about minutes 95 through 100. We've hit the 100th minute of Buckaroo Banzai. Minute 95 starts with Buckaroo's Thermopod pursuing John Worfen's Panther troop ship, and they end with Buckaroo and Penny sharing an intimate moment while voyeuristic black electroids listen in.
Dirty electroids.
These minutes cover, the climax, the big space battle. And, there's some interesting stuff that we can kind of go over in this one.
Yeah. And something we were alluding to earlier. Yeah, Steve, I would agree with you. There are moments where the effects in this movie, whether by accident or by design, are pretty cheesy. But I think there are some really great visuals here in the sequence that, you know, I actually, as I was watching it, I did a double take, like, damn, that's good.
Mm. Yeah, especially like some of the explosion effects that we're going to get later.
Yeah.
But we start out, we're in the sky. This is kind of a continuation of that 1950s sci-fi movie motif, you know, where you used to have saucers on on strings kind of just floating around in the static sky. I think that must be an ode to that type of film. Either that or they really had no budget.
I don't know. I thought the thermopod coming up into the scene and then circling to go after the Panther ship, I thought that was some pretty good motion capture, I think, for the era. And as I alluded to last week, it sort of gives the ship a little bit of personality. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it looks left, it looks right, and then it takes off. The one thing, though, is that weird asymmetrical sea creature design.
Mm.
It started to look like one of Jack Skellington's hands, and it was creeping me out a little bit.
Yeah, what do you think, Steve, of the look of the ships in this film?
Well, I actually like the way they rise into the screen and sort of take off after each other right here.
Mm-hmm.
But they are strange. That tendril ship looks like it came right off the side of a fortress in Flash Gordon, which I guess came out not too long before this.
So the
ship that's turning around here. That's part of a ship, though, right?
Yeah, the thermopod's like an escape pod of sorts.
Yeah.
So, but it's a thermopod.
A thermopod. Yeah, it's no substitutions.
Yeah, it's a good brand name.
I think what makes this work here is the framing on the screen itself. Like, they went with sort of an odd angle where the ship is off, is coming up from the bottom and then off to the right. And I think that's kind of why the motions work so well. There also seems to be a face in the front of the ship, which is off-putting. When the ship faces you, it seems like there's a little man there. I don't think I like that. Like a mole man. Yeah,
the look of the ship, it kind of reminds me of a cross between like some of the Jabba skiff type things that you see in Return of the Jedi and maybe something out of Dune from the period. Maybe it's the color and just the way that they've made the outlines of the ship or something. I don't know.
Dune came out just before this came out, right?
Around the same time, in like 84, yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing the difference in production values between those two films, just to contrast them and everything. Dune went all, you know, sort of high gloss, high production value, and this goes in a completely different, Escape from Mars sort of direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure there must have been a much bigger budget for the Dune one. I think that's kind of... Didn't Dune not do too well when it came out?
No, I don't see how it could have made much money. Do you see anybody doing the Dune Minute? Hold on. Nope.
No, I think that actually exists. I think somebody started it and didn't finish.
Oh, really?
Or something like that. It's in that bucket.
Okay. They died along the way. But yeah, we won't go too far into Dune or, you know, the career of Dino De Laurentiis. But
I like that original Dune movie for what it's worth.
Oh, it definitely had it had its moments. Yeah, and I think what I remember is the original theatrical version that was probably the closest cut to what David Lynch wanted to show. If you've ever seen the expanded TV version that was is actually an Alan Smithy.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, which has the weird prologue featuring, I think, a narration, I think, by Buddy Ebsen.
That's who it was.
That's not what it sounds like, Buddy Ebsen. there two great houses were trying to run the galaxy. Or it might have been Waylon Jennings. About them, the Duke boys show up on House Atreides. But yeah, we'll do the Dune Minute right after we finish this one.
Oh, God.
But the contrast. I think we're in this sequence, we're going to see various examples of low budget, tight budget, no budget filmmaking. Mm. And, I think some solid editing here. And what follows after this cool, thermopod peel out scene is Worfen's cockpit, mm-hmm. that I almost like to think was filmed in John Lithgow's garage.
Yeah, it's got that very tight, that tight sort of shot, kind of claustrophobic look.
Yeah, but the color in the background, it's like everything's popping. It looks like, like something from a Mario Bava 1960s movie. Hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised if this was maybe something they had to reshoot later, and they didn't have that larger cockpit set. Because the lighting looks a little different than, say, in the past 5 minutes. And it's just, it's a nice tight close-up on Lithgow and his goofy helmet and goggles. And you sort of wonder, is this the beginning of the steampunk look? Did it all start here?
Well, it reminded me, actually, of Anakin Skywalker in the pod race with the goggles and the grimace.
Similar goggles. I think Lithgow would have made a much better Anakin Skywalker.
With or without the accent?
Oh, with the accent. I think, because then he would have been well into his 50s and just, the conceit of, he's playing a 10-year-old boy. And just, put him in a ridiculous Buster Brown suit and, have at you. Quick aside, gentlemen, I was in a restaurant with my wife. We were having brunch, and Phantom Menace happened to be on in the background, but with no sound. And you know what? If you don't have to listen to it, it's a great movie. It's just when the characters say something, then they all, But when it's just aliens running around and you don't have to listen to them, genius. Mm. Should be a silent movie.
I seem to recall there was something on the internet where they did a silent movie, like black and white 1920s treatment to Star Wars. And they had like little subtitles and stuff. And it was quite amusing.
Oh, very cool.
To try to find that. Do you like how John O'Connor is in the back with that sort of hanging meat jacket?
I like the jacket just hanging there. I thought that was a very... Well, first I thought it was hanging on the chair, but now I think he's just got it like sort of half off of him.
Yeah, I think that's using kind of like excess foam and other materials that they had for the production. They talk about that a little bit in the Blu-ray, in the making of.
So I have a question. Whose picture is that in the background, hanging on the wall?
When you see inside the thermopod with the heroes, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Worfen. Yeah, that's Lizardo Worfen. A nice little portrait frame with little light.
I think it's a bit of an allusion to, say, Mussolini's in Italy or, Stalinist Russia, where, you have a portrait, a frameable portrait of your fearless leader, in your dining room. So, he's gazing down at you while you eat. And, in this case, it's Worfen in your thermopod,
It's a really well-appointed thermopod. Mm-hmm. I mean, most escape pods on Earth are not, are not that personalized. This one's got little buckets of spice in it, or little cans of spice in it, and it's got the picture and all that. It looks pretty lived in.
Yeah. Well, that's because it's a thermopod. It's not just an escape pod. It's a thermopod. It's the top of the line. It's the Cadillac of escape pods.
This shows everything that's wrong with our culture today. It's all disposable. This is how it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's handcrafted out of the finest seat cushion foam.
But if you look at this scene, the lighting is a little bit odd in this scene, because take a look at John Parker, because you see his Lectroid eyes. They were kind of black in earlier scenes. Now they kind of look light purple. And then we can even see from this angle that, when he opens his mouth, we might be looking at a square air hole in the mask's mouth.
Yeah. And I wasn't sure if you could actually maybe catch a glint of a reflection off of those eyeballs. But, again, I feel like you know, maybe they're in a rush here. And, you know, if they were shooting this in sequence, which I think they might have been doing, you know, this just might have been, yeah, we got to get these cockpit scenes and then move on. But yeah, overall, you know, I just like the almost, you know, do it yourself feel to the, you know, Steve, as you were saying, it's a great set. And it sort of looks like, yeah, they raided a thrift store and, you know, made it work. We could do this in our garage and that's kind of beautiful.
We should do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, do you like the fact that the flight yoke that you have there is, it's not like a ship at all. I mean, it's literally a steering wheel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because it drives like a truck.
That's right.
What's a truck?
I think it would have been awesome if you could change the cockpit view to show some different scenes, because I'm sure that was like 1980s blue screen. But imagine if somebody put in, you know, like NASCAR racing or traffic on the Hollywood freeway, monster truck rallies, that sort of thing.
Yeah, completely. hard not to think of the Death Star trench here.
Oh.
In fact, with this whole sequence, I almost wonder if they're, you know, they're doing a little, like, poking a little fun at, you know, the Star Wars kind of ending.
The whole stay on, you know, target.
Yeah, stay on target. And, you know, here's one, because, you know, there's this whole dialogue between John Parker and, you know, Buckaroo, you know, left. No, my left. No, my right, your left. And I just thought, how many times have we heard that one?
Yeah, directional shenanigans.
Yeah. When does a trope become a trope? And it's sort of, you know, my right is your left, and blah 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 like that. Mm-hmm. It's
or the difference between right and correct, and
yeah. it's right along with, okay, we go on three, and, you know, on three or after three, and
yeah, failure to communicate. Mm-hmm. But why is it, do you think, that they had that gun so that you had to face backwards to be able to aim it? Not exactly the most efficient design when it comes to thermopods.
They don't want the gunner to be distracted while looking out the window.
Right. That must be it.
Because remember, we're talking about Lectroids, and we've learned a little about Lectroids over the course of this movie, but maybe they just have notoriously short attention spans.
Hmm.
It's like, we're coming up on target. Oh, look down there. I think I see a Krispy Kreme donut shop. You know, they're just, you know. Maybe they're a little like dogs. When you're there in the car and they just want to look out the window. So, you know.
Well, we do see the Panther ship that Worfen is frantically using his feet now to move the ship. You know, on the outside, though, when we see the ship, it doesn't really look like they're moving around too much. I mean, this big kind of lumbering thing. I mean, yes, they'll go up and down a little bit, but they're not really turning. And the most notable thing is, where are the guns on the Panther ship? I mean, they have this laser zap thing on the thermopod, but you would think such a big ship would have a way of defending itself.
Whoops.
Minor details.
I'm trying to figure out why they have a keyboard and a bottle of Chianti on the foot pedal thing. I mean, I understand having a keyboard and a bottle of Chianti, but it doesn't seem where I'd put them. Also, what is that thing?
The foot. Oh, yeah. Thing? Yeah, what I think that is an old mechanical style light control panel, possibly, you know, for stage, or possibly, you know, since this is in Hollywood, it might be, you know, for, you know, old, you know, silver screen, you know, like Klieg lights on a set. Seems like I've seen those, you know, in old movies, like, you know, where we're backstage and, you know, you know, and somebody says, hit the lights. And, you know, it's, you're not supposed to really use them with your feet. So I could picture somebody just grabbing that out of storage. And then somebody else, maybe even Lithgow, saying, hey, what if I control these with my feet? And yeah, you know, as far as the bottle of Chianti, I think it's obvious it's for Lizardo. Mm-hmm. My question is, does he pick it up with his toes?
Perhaps he does.
I'd like to think.
And does he put cardamom on it? Because I think that's what that is cardamom next to it.
Oh, the red thing?
Yeah.
Now, I'm embarrassed to admit I don't know what cardamom is. The can looked familiar, but I couldn't place
it. Some sort of spice, right?
Yep.
Okay.
No. And then there's like looks like some sort of wrapper or fried chicken next to it. I don't know.
Yep, yep. Classic Lectroid. You know, empty wrappers everywhere. You know, mm-hmm. The only thing missing is a bag of screaming yellow zonkers.
But zonkers.
Fan of the zonkers?
Sure.
Awesome. Awesome.
Aren't we all?
Well, you know, actually, when we first noticed a bag of screaming yellow zonkers a few episodes back, I think most people were unaware of them or had forgotten about them. But yeah, you know, it was the a response, an aggressive response to years of Cracker Jacks. Mm. You know, screaming yellow zonkers. I know when you're a kid, just the name alone means, oh, that's got to be good.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So now we're back in the thermopod. And yeah, Banzai is, I guess they hear the Panther ship's radio commands. That was another problem with that. You know, not exactly very subtle and in giving away their position. But we get the line, Worfen sayonara.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a good little line for him to say to end it all. And then he does the zap. And when I first saw this movie and I saw that, I was underwhelmed. I mean, I thought, come on, you know, where's the dogfight scene or the narrow trench run with, you know, try to get the thermal exhaust port? No, it's just zap and that's it.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's an interesting point because especially like in this day and age, you'd have a fuel injected CGI overdose of, you know, spaceships doing things that defy gravity and all forms of physics, and it would go on, and you'd have a, you know, it would go back and forth. And, you know, this is one thing I like about this is it's short and sweet. Yeah, in some ways it seems a little anticlimactic, but I like that it's not dragged out.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing artificial. It's sort of like, ah, gotcha, bang, you're dead. Hmm. It's a little like in Big Trouble in Little China, you know, the big climax there.
Yeah.
You know, there's a knife suddenly in Lopan's forehead. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Good night. Drive safe.
I think they actually invested a considerable amount in this little special effect. I'm not underwhelmed by it at all, actually.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. The effects here are really visually stunning. They look really good, so... I think they just kind of don't overdo it, which is kind of nice.
I mean, yeah, the payoff is good. I just felt that it came too quickly. I was kind of thinking, are there going to be more things or more flying scenes at this point? But no, it's
you it's want the Michael Bay version where it goes on for 18 minutes and spaceships tumble and run into, I don't know, what things that you can run into in clouds.
The laser jams, so Buckaroo has to climb outside to fix it. Mm-hmm. And then he falls onto the Panther ship, and he's hanging by one of the tendrils. And then he gets into a kung fu fight with John Gomez and so on and so forth. And, yeah.
Well, there's some good Buckaroo fan fiction out there waiting to be written about it.
Oh, yeah, completely.
That brings me to a very important question. Why is he suddenly parachuting?
Ah, well, we'll get to that in a second, actually, because I just want to give one last comment here about Worfen's death scene. You know, because he does get a little bit of an ending there. You know, he got the processed voice. You know, Banzai, I'll see you in hell. But is he actually blown up with the ship?
That's what I wonder. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a very inconclusive ending. We see a big... pretty explosion. We don't actually see Worfen explode. And also, here's a clue to that. For the past like 10 minutes, it seems as though this character who, you know, again, there's two characters inside this body. It's been mostly Lizardo and, you know, his obsession. I want to go home. Mm-hmm. He thinks the Panther ship is going to take him to Naples. That's not the case. So it seems like Lizardo has kind of been in control. And at this last minute, yeah, we hear that synthesized voice. It's like, well, Worfen's back all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Worfen has he has an escape plan. Maybe his overthruster is able to pull him out at the last minute. Who knows?
Well, but, I do remember from the novelization that in that one, it's pretty clear that the ship blows up and Worfen goes with it. But for some reason, Lizardo appears then. He appears from the eighth dimension as a young man. And he's very confused about what's going on. And then they go on to say that he promptly goes insane, like, right after that. And so he's kind of back into the in the asylum that he used to be.
So that this might all be happening in his head is what you're saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, he kind of did get taken over by the personality of Worfen when he got halfway stuck through into the eighth dimension, back in 1938. So he's been living as a dual personality all this time. And now, in the novel at least, he is freed from that. But the whole experience of being in the eighth dimension has made him insane, so he doesn't really get a happy ending.
I have two questions for you guys, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot.
No.
Not at all.
I feel like this is an important moment. And since you guys have basically created the definitive text on Buckaroo Banzai, would you agree with that?
Well, there are others out there that have done a lot more than we have over the years, but we're probably the most recent, at least, to be talking about this one.
Speaking as someone who's barely aware of the movie, I think you guys have, I think you guys are going to go down in his people, scholars are going to refer to the text of this podcast. So I want to make sure I understand a couple things.
Okay.
First of all, do you both think he's dead? And I mean dead, dead.
It depends what you consider canon.
Yeah.
Because there is a comic book series that was done in the early 2000s. It was called Return of the Screw. And it was done by Earl MacRouche and W.D. Richter. And in that one, Lizardo comes back. And he is the villain in that one again. So if you consider that canon, no, he survived.
Yeah. To kind of add to that, I think a good screenwriter will make a character disappear, but won't kill him off outright. So yeah, I think they left it open. For some reason, this brings to mind Lawrence Kasdan when he was writing Raiders of the Lost Ark. You never see Abner Ravenwood. You hear about Abner Ravenwood.
Mm-hmm.
You get a sense that Abner Ravenwood is under several tons of ice. But Kasdan left it open so that, yeah, maybe that character would show up at another time in another movie.
Mm-hmm.
Still waiting for that to happen. But, I think you a good screenwriter, especially if you're talking about the possibility of a sequel or doing a series,
mm-hmm.
You stay one, two steps ahead of the game. So, yeah, I would say Lizardo, Worfen alive, why not?
Yeah. Well, they were planning on doing a sequel, the World Crime League, though that probably would have focused on the other bad guy, Hanoi Shan. But yeah, I wonder if the plan was to bring Lizardo back for the sequel that was planned.
My second question to you guys, is there any chance this is all happening in Lizardo's head? I mean, the entire Buckaroo Banzai universe.
Mm.
Sure.
I like that. That's very fever dream-esque, isn't it?
We all love a good fever dream in these minute podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't we?
What is it? Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Who, end of the movie, we flash forward to the insane asylum where the character's been all along.
Mm.
So yeah, we could totally mess with the audience and add, the ship explodes, and Worfen's back in the asylum.
Yeah, and you just see him unplugging that thing from his tongue again.
Yeah.
It was just happening like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. So this could all be a completely demented, paranoid, lithium-induced dream of Lizardo. That's, yeah. In fact, now that you bring it up, I'm certain that's what it is.
And Buckaroo Banzai may be the idealized version of a hero that Lizardo always wanted to be.
Yeah. He is a comic book character.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great conceits of this movie is he's a real life figure who has this amazing multimedia franchise around him. You know the video games, the comic books, the records. But it's the opposite. He's a comic book character who the paranoid Lizardo is thinks is real. And so none of this happened.
Hmm.
There we go.
Huh. Yeah, somebody could do an edit where they can just kind of show him, yeah, unplugging at the very end of it, and then you see the comic book kind of closing or something.
Yeah, end of story.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like that, Steve.
Yeah, we've destroyed the movie.
Well, my work here is done. I've been waiting since I was a child in Massapequa all those years ago to destroy this silly movie, and now I've done my work.
Wow. But no. But the movie is not destroyed. Instead, the Panther ship is destroyed. And just to talk a little bit about that, that kind of explosion with the pink and the clouds. My note here was that, I mean, it's a neat effect. It looks cool. It's just different than a lot of the stuff that we see in some of the other films. We don't see any chunks of the machine in the aftermath.
Right? Yeah.
That's something you would see more in, I think, Star Trek. Pieces are shown here.
Yeah. I like it. It's almost pretty. A pretty explosion. It's almost like fireworks.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. If you have limited budget, this is the right choice. You're doing something that's actually a good version of the thing you can do, as opposed to a bad version of the thing you can't do. I mean... It's artistic.
I mean, it's a better approach than what they did back in the woods. If you remember when the thermopod was supposed to explode and you just kind of see a flash of light off in the distance. And,
Yeah.
They had some budget for this one, and that's good.
It looks good. It looks good.
But then we shoot back to the black Lectroid mothership, and we get that silver-jacketed Lectroid with the black hockey goalie gloves. And he says, John Worfen destroyed, and they deactivate the particle beam at 000. They're very quick. They were monitoring exactly what was happening.
Yeah. So those are, in fact, hockey goalie gloves. I was wondering about that.
It certainly looks like it.
Yeah. This is where we had Greg on just a couple of weeks ago. He could probably identify the exact, brand.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of some of the stuff you see in the movie Tron. I believe they used a lot of hockey equipment on that one, helmets and pads and other things.
Hmm. I like that, when he buries his fist into his glove.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've commented how, Carl Lumley is John Parker. One of the things that makes his performance so fun is weird hand gestures.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he, as a Lectroid, he doesn't quite know how you make hand gestures on Earth. And it's kind of like this guy. He's like, I guess I should, make some significant hand gesture here.
I think this is my favorite alien in the movie. I really like his hair.
Oh, with the feather stuff, you mean?
Yeah.
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 He looks like a weak wave from Return of the Jedi, but with, with like somebody's weird feather hair thing.
Mm-hmm. let's actually move on at this point to what we see in the clouds. And now we can talk about the parachute appearing. So we hear the main title theme play and then the parachute appears. So the question is, why do you suppose that he has a parachute to get out of this escape pod? Why did he choose to do that?
It was a nice day. I think he just, it's Buckaroo Banzai. I think he said, hey, let me parachute out. It's no problem. I think it was also a courtesy. Mm-hmm. I also kind of wonder, with John Parker's questionable flying skills, maybe landing or even taking off in the thing was a bit risky. So it was like, you just keep going this way and you'll be fine. And I'll just get out now. And maybe he was also like, I'm going to die with this guy at the controls. So
I want to go on record as saying I really like the Buckaroo Banzai theme music here.
Mm.
You know what's funny? There's a lot I like about this movie in components. I just don't like it in aggregate.
Yeah. Yeah.
but as to why he had to jump out, he is a comic book character first and foremost, and this is what he would do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but where did he get the parachute? I don't remember seeing him carrying a bag with stuff or whatever. Do you suppose that was on the thermopod somewhere next to the portrait?
Yeah, I guess we have to just assume it's a thermopod. It's just a standard operational equipment on the thermopod.
And when they're in outer space, does it come with a little helmet to go with the parachute?
Outer space? You didn't say anything about going to outer space. Wait a minute. it's a funny thing about thermopods, escape pods, whatever you want to call them. You just think about the, you're heading in one direction.
We're going to go to that giant matte painting planet where, of course, the oxygen is going to be fine. So you don't think about, you know, going back. You know, maybe this thing doesn't have a reverse on the drive panel. So, you know, the music is it sounds like some kind of synthesizer graduation theme. It's, you know, class valedictorian.
Yeah, it's the same music we hear at the very beginning of the movie when we have the Star Wars crawl intro. Yeah. And we don't hear that.
It's very victorious.
The Jamie Lee Curtis version. But yeah, it is neat music. Very, very 80s, very synth, very pomp and circumstance. Very appropriate sounding.
I also really like Peter Weller's eyeliner here.
Does he have eyeliner?
I think he's got eyeliner and lip blusher, lip gloss, whatever that is on. He's wearing a lot of makeup.
Well, he's a new wave rocker. That would make sense.
True.
the shot is it's very 80s blue screen. That's sort of straight on of Buckaroo floating down while wearing the parachute. reminding me of some of the stuff we see in like Superman, for instance.
Sure.
And then we he gives his salute to the thermopod. So John Parker, he does this fancy spin move as he flies off with the thermopod. But I thought he had failed flight school. Where's this coming from?
Well, Wesley Crusher got kicked out of Starfleet Academy for fancy flying, if I remember correctly.
It's the power of Buckaroo Banzai. He just, you know, just being around the guy for 5 minutes and, you know, he's a nice pilot.
That's right. Being around Banzai makes you better. I think we've seen that in a couple instances in this film. But then we do get to see a real shot of somebody parachuting down, you know, with Buckaroo landing. And, you know, they do a nice little transition to show probably from the stunt person to the real Peter Weller. But he makes it on the ground, hugs all around. And immediately Buckaroo, he's concerned about Penny. I thought that was interesting that, you know, he's thinking about that.
Yeah. That's kind of what the whole mission was about for him, at least. It's probably been on his mind, all along. I like Perfect Tommy's, you know, very somewhat sarcastic line, you know, it's classic tough guy talk. Man, I thought you'd really bought it this time. You know, there's no room to be like sincere or sympathetic. I was so worried, man. I thought this was, it was like, you know, it's got to be sort of flippant. Even Buckaroo comes back with, what did he say? Like, so did I, you know, this is how tough guys talk.
Now, Steve, you were talking about earlier that Perfect Tommy is your favorite of the Hong Kong Cavaliers. Is that right?
I very much like Perfect Tommy. Perfect Tommy is doing a, excellent Iceman by Val Kilmer from Top Gun. He just works for me. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's a good reference right there, actually.
I'm keeping it 80s today. Hi, and welcome to Keeping It 80s. I'm with Josh Horowitz and Brett Stillo today. We're discussing Buckaroo Banzai.
Let's see. We've moved on now. We're on the porch. This is the part where we see the Secretary of Defense trying to bribe Scooter to get the overthruster back with a shiny $20 bill. And I have a note here.
Wait, that's the Secretary of Defense?
That's the Secretary of Defense, Mr. John McKinley.
John McKinley.
Yes.
Who seems to be left over from the Nixon administration somehow.
Yeah.
There's a lot wrong with this here. I mean, this kid points a gun at his face.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was trying to steal the overthruster, and like a good Blue Blaze irregular, you know, he's a member of Team Banzai. He doesn't want that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and then we've, you know, through the movie, we've seen, you know, what a rat McKinley is. There's nothing likable about him.
Well, I do have a note here, though, about the $20 bill that he tries to bribe him with. According to a site called Dollar Times, $20 in 1984 is worth about $48 in 2018. And back in 1984, you could watch Buckaroo Banzai in theaters for $2.50, and you could get a gallon of gas for about $1.10, or you could buy a Macintosh computer for $2,500.
Man, I miss the 80s.
Hmm.
But but I think minimum wage was $1.75 back then. I'm trying to remember.
No, it was $3.25, I think.
Okay, $3.25. Okay.
Riches.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time I had a job for minimum wage working at a Cinnabon in the San Fernando Valley. And I think that was back in 19, I want to say 1993 in the summer, and I think I was making probably about $6 an hour at that point.
Not bad for a Cinnabon. Mm-hmm. Not bad.
And all the Cinnabons I could eat.
All the Cinnabon you could eat.
I don't know. I was trying to remember, what $20 was, what that meant in 1984. I feel like Scooter still should have held out for more.
You could buy your weekly comic books with $20, I imagine.
Yeah, you probably could. I mean, what do you think that that Scooter would do with that 20? Actually, well, he what he will do, since he seems to have taken the 20 and kept the overthruster.
I see him buying $12 for the comic books, mm-hmm. $5 for the candy, and having maybe $3 left over for miscellaneous tasks. Miscellaneous items.
Yeah, no, could be. Well, moving on. I like the fact that even though the $20 bribe doesn't work, he starts to offer his hat because that'll do the trick. And the secretary, he's going to walk off coolly, and that's going to be the end of him. Farewell, Secretary McKinley. I do like the ending, though. When we see Scooter actually is the one who saves the day. He's able to give the overthruster back to Buckaroo. And
what device is the actual, just that little thing that he hands off as the overthruster, right?
Yeah, that little thing about the size of a pear or peach.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, that's the MacGuffin in the movie. It
does all this trouble for such a small thing.
Yeah, all the magic. But I like the fact that it makes the little sound effect remind us that that's the overthruster. Buckaroo then promotes him to take Perfect Tommy's job, and Tommy seems kind of cool at this news. I guess the thing is, has he then lost his job? Is he no longer perfect?
God, dear, I think Tommy is confident in his position, in his role. He realizes he's indispensable. He's not going anywhere.
Hmm.
So he's cool. I mean, which is the perfect way to handle this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the perfect way. So he is still perfect. Even in his imperfection, he shows signs of being perfect.
If anything, he should be threatened by Jeff Goldblum. if he's threatened by this 8-year-old kid who is all smiles and all goodness, then, that is imperfect, Tommy.
Whoops. Now would you look at that. Thermomagnetic gash in space-time, right in the middle of New Jersey. There goes my day off. Let's see. Duct tape, staple gun.
Sorry, Brett.
That's okay. You guys have fun. I'll see you later.
I have to just continue. It's going to be me and you, Steve, through the end of this. Yes.
Quite the promotion. I hope Perfect Tommy doesn't feel threatened.
Yeah, unfortunately, Brett is now in the bowels of Yo-Yo Dines, but we're gonna continue to run through this as best we can here. Let's see. So, he offers him a ride in the jet car. I would think that would be a pretty cool reward at the very end for a kid his age. What do you think?
I think a jet car sounds wonderful now. I would take a jet car ride from anybody who offered me one.
Yeah. Though it's good that he offered, he doesn't do it without permission from his dad, of course.
His dad hardly seems like he fits in with this group. I mean, I don't know much about this actor. I don't even know his name.
Mm-hmm.
He's unfortunately got a little bit of token black character going on here, right here.
Hmm.
Because he just seems he just doesn't seem like one of the gang.
Well, the thought was that, he's considered a Blue Blaze irregular, so that means he's, kind of just on the outside helping Team Banzai. But we were speculating that maybe he's an ex-Vietnam vet. I mean, he's got that helicopter, so he's probably a pilot at one point. And he's taught a thing or two to his son. I mean, the Scooter's along for the ride. Heck, he gives him an M16. I mean, that's...
Oh, so the dad's not in the band?
No. No, he's a Blue Blaze irregular, kind of like an ode to back when Sherlock Holmes had his Baker Street irregulars. It's kind of the same thing there.
I thought that was only for children, so I thought only the kid was an irregular. I didn't understand that he's just a bad parent.
No, no, they're both both part of that that org. I think Scooter was given. A half. I mean, he was like Blue Blaze irregular, like 11 and a half or something, because he's a kid.
Oh, it's going to be so awkward when Scooter becomes part of, like, starts doing keyboards for the band, and this guy gets left, and Dad gets left behind. That's going to be so, so, so awkward in, like, 4 years, in, like, 1988, when they're trying to compete with New Order or something like that. Oh, dear.
Well, we're back at the bus now, and we get a shot of New Jersey. I found that he looks pretty cool in this, actually. You know, he's not wearing his hat. He's got his eye black on. He's wearing that red cowboy shirt with the rolled up sleeves. You know, this is his cool mode, but he's also pretty sad because, well, he did all he could. Very, very sort of traditional doctor line.
This is Jeff Goldblum showing the world that he can wear anything, say anything, and he will look good and emote. It's a career defining moment for Jeff Goldblum.
Yes. Well, he's had an interesting role in this film, and we've been able to pull out the Goldblumizer, or no, what do we call that? The Goldblumometer, actually, throughout this, to try to see just how Jeff Goldblum he is in these scenes. And so I wonder if we were to turn up the Goldblumometer in this one, what the reading would be. What do you think?
Ooh. Not knowing the measurings on the Goldblumometer, I would say that they are a hot 8.5, sizzling with deep, caring, emotional appeal.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll have to check and make sure that is accurate.
My God, I've got a crush on Jeff Goldblum. What do my wife think?
Well, now we're back on World Watch 1, and we get that classic gag from the trailer. The president is on line 1. Is everything okay with the alien spacecraft, or just destroy Russia? That's we get that whole gag about yes on 1, no on 2, and which was yes, yet Buckaroo leaves. So what I think would be awesome here would be a few minutes past this, suddenly we get a shot out the window where the world explodes because of this mistake.
I'm going to go with this something. They do actually attack Russia, and this is what leads to what's the movie with the Wolverines in
it? Oh, Red Dawn.
Red Dawn. This leads directly into Red Dawn.
It's around the same time period. Why not?
Yeah. 84. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And then we're in Buckaroo's berth, and oh no, we got the white sheet over something in the bed. We get our sad synth music. I like how they seem to spend a long time on this shot. You know, they seem to blaze through all the action scenes that we saw before, but we're really focusing now on this final act part with Penny and Buckaroo. And then they whip off the sheet. We see Penny with her arms folded over her chest, and she looks a little gray. So what did you do? You remember when you saw this for the first time? Did you think that she was dead and then that was going to be it? Or
she's the hard part of the movie for me
because
the whole scene where she tries to kill herself in the club is where I sort of go, all right, this isn't for me. in fact, I know we're running a little short on time, but I made a note of this. From the Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Banzai and the Hong Kong Cavaliers are performing at a nightclub where Banzai interrupts their musical intro to address a depressed and suicidal woman, Penny Pridley, in the audience. During her performance, he gives especially for her, she attempts suicide, which is mistaken for an assassination attempt upon Banzai. After bailing her out of jail, he finds she is the long-lost twin sister of his late wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of where, when I watched this movie finally a few months ago, I was like, all right, this really isn't for me.
Yeah. I didn't get...
That is a lot.
I didn't even get the whole, you know... twin of the dead wife thing when I saw it the first time, and I still needed to sort of wrap my head around just what that was all about. Even on subsequent viewings, we've sort of gone over this over and over on this podcast, just this whole thing with this Penny paradox that they talk about in the novel and stuff. I mean, it's, if you think about it, if that is not his dead wife and that is the twin sister, now he's macking on his dead wife's twin sister. It's kind of weird.
Everybody's got a heel, Josh. Everybody's got a heel.
Yeah, in their own way. Well, and then the question is, though, is that Peggy? Is that his dead wife who's been kind of brainwashed? And we've been speculating that on the show, too.
I'm going to go back to my dream theory
and
say that, is Peggy the wife?
Peggy is the wife, yeah.
All right, Peggy was actually the doctor's wife. What's the
Lizardo?
Yeah, Lizardo's wife.
Whoa.
remember, he was in having a dream thing.
Uh-huh.
So, with and then in his dream, in his, you know, his created universe,
uh-huh.
Penny. He created Penny to fill that need for his dead wife or his lost wife.
Well, you may that's what I'm going with there. Yeah. Well, many ways to take this film, that's for sure.
Speculative interpretation from a guy who's barely paid attention to the movie.
Indeed. but we get the ending part here. He leans over to kiss and zap. And we get this shot of the Lectroid commander on the ship slowly grinning. So I guess, is this implied then that the Lectroid commander somehow did this, was able to bring her back to life through that zap?
The Wikipedia feels like it is.
Yeah.
But it certainly looks like it. I mean, it certainly looks like what they're trying to trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Buckaroo rubs his zap nose. He sees the leg rising and goes over to do a slow kiss this time. And my note is that, you know, I mean, see, it's always better not to rush to first base.
Yeah. It's always better to go back.
Well, yeah. but her eyes open. She's all right. And then we see that back at the mothership, they actually, I guess they can hear what's going on. So how are they able to have this voyeuristic ability?
And I actually thought for a second they were talking through her.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were animating her.
Oh,
by the way, they cut this little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is kind of gross.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. They trade banter for a little bit, and Penny grabs Buckaroo for a kiss, being sort of she wants it. This is the 80s. Why not?
It's all good.
And that ends the 5 minutes. So. So yeah, I'm sorry that Brett couldn't be around for the ending on this one, but I wanted to thank you, Steve, for taking the time and talking Buckaroo with us. Hey, yeah, it was fun having you on.
It's always a pleasure, Josh.
Yes, absolutely. And why don't you tell our guests a little bit about the X Minutes podcast that you're working on?
Surely. So let's see. Thomas Howeth, Jerry O'Brien, and myself are doing X Minutes. The X Minutes podcast, where we discuss the X-Men movies one scene at a time. We're about halfway through the first X-Men movie now. And you can find out more about it at xminutespodcast.com. We're on all the normal social media channels, but if you really want to dig into it with us, the Danger Room on Facebook is where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like the X-Men, if you like Marvel's Merry Mutants, you'll have a good time. Guaranteed.
Very good. Yeah, got to be sure to check that out. And for our own guests, be sure to visit us at 5minutesofbonsai.com. You can also check us out on Facebook at 5 Minutes of Bonsai and Twitter at 5 Minutes Bonsai. We also have a listeners group on Facebook called the 5 Minutes of Bonsai Bunkhouse, so please come and check it out. You can join today. We only have one more episode before we're done with this film, so you got to join and talk to us before it's done. Though I have a feeling we'll still be talking Buckaroo for a bit after that. And this is a weekly podcast. One more week left, but you can subscribe to us on iTunes so you get new episodes each Tuesday. We're also on Stitcher and Google Play. And before we're done with this podcast, guys, please rate us on iTunes if you can. Leave us your highest review possible. And tell your friends about the podcast so others can listen and enjoy. So that's pretty much it. Any last thoughts, Steve?
Just congratulations on a great journey.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And this is World Watch 1 signing off. Tune in next time for another 5 minutes of Bonsai. And remember,
no matter where you go, there you are.
Now, where were we?